You got your vaccines and you're ready to safely do the fun spring things that you used to take for granted. During this year of upheaval, Prairie Public's been a constant source of radio companionship, delivering the news, music, entertainment, enlightenment, and inspiration that you needed and still need to navigate a tumultuous world. During this season of renewal and optimism, please don't forget Prairie Public. We rely on listener contributions to make all the things that you enjoy about it possible. And one thing you and your family might enjoy a lot is an NPR jigsaw puzzle. Yeah, it's yours for a $15 a month sustaining membership. Just call or text the word donate to 800-359-4145 or give online at prairiepublic.org. Thanks, and I hope to see you soon out there.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and it is the last day of April, time to do our monthly journalist roundtable. We have our special guest, as always, Dave Thompson, news director for Prairie Public, joins us from our Bismarck studio. Dave, thanks for joining us today.
You're very welcome, Ashley.
We also have from the Williston Herald, Renee Jean. She is the assistant managing editor. Renee, thank you.
Good to be here.
And from the Forum of Fargo-Moorhead, we have editor Matt Von Panon. Matt, thanks for joining us today.
Glad we could be together today.
I want to start with talking about some of the latest on COVID. Dave, why don't you start?
Well, the big thing is today the executive orders have expired.
Right.
And now the restrictions
are lifted. For tomorrow?
Okay. But there is a worry in the state health department that we're seeing more of these, you know, new variants around. So people, they're saying that, yeah, the restrictions have been lifted, but please do the things you've been doing. Social distancing, washing your hands, wearing masks when you can, but make sure you get vaccinated too.
Right. And the vaccine doses, I last recall something like 500,000 doses. Now, of course, roughly two-thirds of the vaccines available are a double dose. So
exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. There's still a concern that there might be fatigue out there. I know that over the last few weeks, you've seen more and more organizations go to walk-in vaccinations. So you don't have to have an appointment. You can actually walk into a pharmacy and get a vaccination now.
Renee, how are you seeing the rollout happening in the West?
Well, I think in the West, you probably see more of that vaccine hesitancy. And, of course, vaccine hesitancy is pretty high in North Dakota in general. We're like the two highest states were North Dakota and Wyoming. If you add up the numbers of hesitant to very hesitant, they're 48%, so almost half of our population. And so, it's kind of a concern, I think, because of the variants. Every infection is another chance to create a new form of this.
Matt, how about you are paying a little bit more attention to this on the east side?
Yeah, I think definitely on the east side of the state, we're seeing pretty good take rates of vaccine. And anybody who wants one can come and get one at any time now. They've opened that up for everyone. We did have a story earlier this week that was kind of interesting about a couple of big health systems in our area that were finding that some doctors and nurses were not vaccinating, and they're trying to actually start an internal campaign to make sure more of those healthcare workers are getting vaccinated.
Was that a case of themselves having vaccine hesitancy, or were they wanting to save the vaccine doses for other people?
It sounds like it was more vaccine hesitancy on their part. And some of that, and mind you, it was a relatively small percentage, but it was interesting because they were finding that a few of the healthcare workers had some concerns that it was still an early vaccine, that it was
developed quickly.
Developed quickly. So that was where some of the hesitancy came in.
Yeah, I guess I'm curious too. Just as you all are out talking to people a little bit more than I have been, I'm curious what you are hearing about the vaccine hesitancy, because it almost feels like a dirty word to say that you might have some concerns about, you know, putting this thing in your body. And I have heard some people who don't want to say they're vaccine hesitant because they're just getting sort of, I don't know, thrown under a bus at all. Have you heard that at all? Renee, why don't you go ahead and go first?
Well, in just talking with my circle of friends, I don't hear any hesitancy about saying that people are vaccine hesitant. They feel like it's been a rush job. Those are some of the things that I hear. Hmm. One thing I would say to that, the technology for this mRNA vaccine has actually been 10 years in the making. The backbone of it was developed for the MERS outbreak some time ago. And it has a plug-and-play type of aspect to it, so you can take a piece off of it and put a new piece on. That's where a lot of the safety data came in for the emergency use authorization. So it's actually, it's maybe, it feels fast,
mm-hmm.
But there's a lot of research and data behind it.
Yeah, Ashley, we did try to poll people on the eastern side of the state. We actually went out on the street and tried to talk to people about this issue. And I will say that in Fargo-Moorhead, in our area, you know, we had to talk to two or three, for every person that was hesitant, there was probably, you know, two or three, maybe four people that had been vaccinated or were going to be vaccinated. So, but of the people that we spoke to that were hesitant, the main issue that seemed to come up was this just concern that it may not be entirely safe, and they wanted to kind of give it more time. And we did also run into some younger women who had expressed a little bit of concern if they had
increased
planned
stroke
to become
rates,
pregnant.
Right? Okay.
Right, or things like that too. So yeah, it was interesting to talk to people. We really tried to give people a voice for however they're feeling. But as you say, I think there may be some people that are concerned about even disclosing the fact that they're hesitant mm-hmm. because of, you know, possibly the criticism that they might get.
Yeah. Dave, let's talk about the universities, because as I understand it, they are not planning on requiring the COVID-19 vaccine come fall semesters. That's correct?
That is correct so far. They're encouraging it, very strongly encouraging it, but not requiring it. And, you know, going back to some of this discussion about hesitancy,
mm-hmm.
I heard a lot of discussion about that when they talked about these, you know, prohibiting vaccine passport bills.
Mm-hmm.
There were a couple that came up. And there were some people in the legislature, too, who were saying this was a rush job, as Renee mm-hmm. said, or that, you know, this was emergency use approved only,
mm-hmm.
and they just worry about it. Now, here are some of the conspiracy theories that have been postulated to me, which I'm shaking my head at the one. They said, we've heard that the vaccine changes your DNA. And where did that come from? I have not heard that. But I've heard that it also may—and this was actually said on the floor of the House, that one person who is not getting vaccinated says, I want to have kids, so I'm not getting the vaccine. So there's a few things that are just very strange out there.
Yeah.
It came from the internet.
I think so, yes. And we all know everything on the internet is true, right?
Right. The thing about it is since it's mRNA, RNA, people, I think, conflate that with DNA.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't inject itself into your DNA, so it's not changing your DNA at all. It, RNA is a substance that instructs the cell in your body to make different compounds. It's like a messenger.
Mm-hmm.
The nucleus in your cell will send a message, and when it sends a message, it uses that mRNA. But the message itself doesn't change your DNA.
Dave,
does that make sense?
That does make sense, yes.
Dave, the legislature has been, let's just say, busy.
Yes.
Let's talk about the big bonding bill. $680 million, looks like a lot of infrastructure and flood planning, but also some buildings at NDSU.
That's correct. And this, remember, it came down because the governor had suggested $1.2 billion. The Republicans at first had a $1.1 billion bonding bill.
So it was about half that.
Senator Mathern had a $2 billion bill. Now, there's a lot of hesitancy toward bonding, especially in the House of Representatives. They're saying that, you know, why do we need to do this? We can pay cash for it, you know, if we save up the cash. Those who are saying we need to bond is because, A, the cost of money is cheap. Also, if we get these projects done, like, for example, the FM diversion project, you get it done now, you don't have to pay exorbitant rates for doing it in phases. So you get it off the books and then you free up some money from that Water Resources Trust Fund for other projects. So there was a lot of discussion on that.
Well, and certainly, Matt, the FM diversion has been a hot topic across the state, but, you know, as one can logically assume, it would dramatically impact the Fargo-Moorhead and areas north and south of that. What are you guys watching for this?
Yeah, well, I think $680 million dollars worth, if I'm correct on that, would go to the diversion. So it was a big news, obviously, in our area. And, you know, it seems now that with most of the obstacles removed and the money starting to really flow into that, that we're going to start to see the building of that project really begin in earnest, probably this summer and fall.
Yeah.
And now, you know, they're saying maybe 7 to 8 years, 7 to 8 years.
To completion?
To completion.
Okay.
Yeah. And so I think we'll start to, you know, this has been a long time coming. It's been 11, 12 years now since the big flood.
Yeah.
And I remember when you know, shortly after the flood and when there was a lot of effort and focus on getting a diversion built, people thought that it might take 7 to 8 years at that point, at its fastest. And now we're 11 or 12 years out from that event, and we're really just getting going
started.
In a big way.
Yeah, it reminds me a little of what Renee was talking about with the vaccine development is maybe we're not always aware of all the things happening in the background, because to me it sort of feels like I had heard a number so far in the future that I just didn't think that the FM diversion was going to happen at all. And then all of a sudden it was like, oh, now we're going to start in maybe this summer, this fall. So
yeah, and there have been a lot of things going on around the diversion.
Yeah,
for several years, really. I mean, there's been a lot of site work, and trying to get permission from landowners and all those things, which is incredibly.
I can't imagine the logistics.
Challenging. Yeah, just even sort of paving the path, if you will. For it is a massive undertaking, let alone the construction that goes into it. So there has been a lot of work. A lot of people probably don't see it because it's not right in the metro area. A lot of it's been happening on the far south side or just, again, gaining landowner approvals and stuff. So I think we will start to see a much bigger presence of that project starting here this summer and fall.
And, Dave, we're coming up on the 10-year anniversary of the big Souris River flood in Minot. What are we seeing? Because some of this is also earmarked for that flood.
Right, but the flood control project, Mouse River Flood Control, is Minot plus the remainder of what's on the Mouse or Souris River.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a pretty big project, and they figured with the bonding bill they could take a bite out of the FM diversion thing, get that thing, you know, really moving.
Mm-hmm.
And Mouse River has been, shall we say, it's been moving along. They've done a lot of work on there, but there's a lot more work to do. And there's some waiting on some federal funding on that too.
Is any of this earmarked for infrastructure needs that might be more related to energy and ag?
Well, just the ag thing, that's the NDSU
building at NDSU.
The Harris Hall, which is going to be a new agricultural center. They're going to move the Northern's Crops Institute over there, and they're going to move in the trade office, and they're trying to make it more of a you know, a showcase of agriculture, and NDSU being, you know, known for its agriculture development and research.
Yeah. Renee, are you aware of any of this money for needs out in the West?
One thing I do know is that the budget does include that $30 million loan for U.S. Highway 85 to match federal funding if they can get it to four-lane, about 11-mile section of that road. They've tried, I don't know, multiple times in the past to get that, and they haven't succeeded yet, mm-hmm. so it's not a given that that $30 million will do anything. But as you probably are aware, Highway 85 at one time led the boom in fatalities.
Right.
So it's a pretty dangerous stretch that was never designed with the oil-filled traffic in mind.
Yeah. Well, and as I recall, the funding or the push for this, of course, was because of those fatalities and just the huge amount of increased traffic on that road. As oil production numbers haven't stayed as high, does it still seem like there is a need to make that four lanes?
I mean, I've driven on that a few times, and I would say yes. It's not just oil field traffic on there, but it's regular traffic meeting oil field traffic. There's nowhere to go if there's a problem. There's no shoulder. It's a very safe environment.
Renee, you have been, speaking of energy, doing a whole energy reporting series. What is the energy chaser segment that you're doing?
Oh, this is, I'm really excited about this. It came about because we heard from a lot of people in the industry. They were trying to share my articles, but they kept hitting the paywall. Mm. Sorry about that, but, you know, newspapers are a business, too. We've got to make a living. But so we were able to secure a sponsor for the oil and gas coverage, Basin Safety Consulting and Training, so that we can take those oil and gas stories out from behind the paywall. And we've added a free newsletter that kind of delivers you a weekly roundup of that coverage to your inbox, wherever you are. It doesn't matter. It goes out across the state, across the nation even. And, of course, the more signups we can get for this newsletter, the more likely we can keep the paywall down on the oil and gas coverage.
And so you're doing a lot right now on the latest on the DAPL pipeline.
Oh, yeah. It's DAPL tennis.
So where is the DAPL tennis ball at right now?
Right now, the DAPL tennis ball is right back where we started on April 9th. With the Biden administration, the judge in the case said that he wants the federal government to take a stronger stance and weigh in on whether the judge should shut down the pipeline. The Biden administration has already said that they don't want to take a strong stance on it and that the oil can still flow, but that they're also continuing to evaluate the situation and could change their mind anytime. So that's where it's at.
Dave, I am interested in this merger, the health department and human services. This passed, one of those every vote counts kinds of things, one vote.
Yeah, this is interesting. But, you know, that merger bill came out, to me, it came out of nowhere. It was just kind of proposed when the session began. And it was Representative Robin Weiss from Hertzfield who did it. He's been a longtime chairman of the House Human Services Committee. So he said, you know, why not merge these two agencies? You've got this big agency, which has 2,900 plus employees. That's human services. Then you've got the health, which is down to about 200 because they took environment out of it. And they have a separate agency for the, you know, the environmental and the water quality, things like that. So they're saying, okay, let's merge it. Let's find some efficiencies. Let's find some things that you could do at the top levels, but so you don't hurt services. So this is a merger that was approved. The governor has signed it, but it's going to take probably a couple years to really roll out. Mm-hmm. The merger date is going to be next September 2022. But they think that when it gets to a full merger, you're going to be talking about 2 to 4 years after that because there's a need to, you know, reconcile some things. They have some things that are very close, you know, some things that are assigned to them that are very close, and you need to reconcile that too.
Yeah. They always say in mergers that they won't result in job losses, and then it seems like Somehow there's always a they find redundancies.
Well, let's just say that this is the second time I've watched bills where they've tried to merge. Mm. If you remember, there was actually a merger of what they Human Services became the Department of Human Services in the 1980s. And I remember the arguments on that bill and how that went back and forth. And they decided, okay, we're going to merge now. And it did take a little while to roll that one out. So, and then there was a proposal to combine Game and Fish with Parks and Rec to have a natural resources department. That did not go anywhere. But maybe that could be something that could be revived.
Matt, you said that you want to talk about the census, and specifically North Dakota is getting a pretty decent population percentage gain in the census.
Yeah, I was going to review that. I was trying to remember the percentage offhand, but I know we were among the top states as far as a percentage of growth in the last 10 years. Of course, a lot of the growth has moved south and west, as it's been doing for years and years, but to have a state in the upper Midwest that grew by a rather large percentage, I think, surprised a lot of people.
Yeah. How hard was the census to get done this time around? I feel like those deadlines got extended and extended. And, I mean, you're talking about pandemic. There was this big government. You know, there was a lot of mistrust of the census this time around, too.
Yeah, there was. And I know that, you know, obviously, the pandemic caused a lot of problems. People weren't able to canvass as much as they did in the past, so there was a lot more reliance on people taking part, educating people on how to take part, and things like that. But I think one thing that, you know, it's always interesting when you see the state numbers come out, but I think what will be perhaps more interesting in North Dakota is where the population has shifted.
That's what I'm wondering.
Years, yeah, yeah. That's the next kind of layer of information that we expect to come out, and I think that will be very interesting for the state of North Dakota.
That's what we're watching for in the West.
What specifically are you watching?
I want to see if it's going to mean we get some more representation at the Capitol.
Mm. Yeah, because redistricting is coming up this year, and it looks like they won't get a lot of the county-by-county or city-by-city numbers probably until August at the earliest, and they're expecting maybe a lot of that information won't come until September. Then, if I may, just to talk about the process that they're talking about,
they have
a special committee they're going to designate to work on the redistricting plans. They will hold hearings, probably a series of 7 or 8 hearings around the state, and then they'll have a plan ready for a December special session. But Renee is right that some of these districts had gotten really big for a legislative district. As a matter of fact, I think there was a district in western North Dakota that I think was bigger than the state of Rhode Island. So you're talking about, you know, a lot of space to cover. Now it looks like maybe you might see some different lines because there appears to be at least anecdotal evidence that some people who have moved to the Bakken have stayed, and that a lot of, you know, a lot of population you saw walking around was you know, that transient population who were there for 2 weeks and then went home, came back for 2 weeks, then went home. As we're going toward more production, at least this is what the census people tell me, as they're going more toward oil production, that's people who are moving their families there and they're settling. However, is that, you know, is that being reflected? There are a lot of questions yet to be answered, especially with this redistricting plan.
You're listening to our April Journalists Roundtable. That is Dave Thompson, news director for Prairie Public. We're also visiting with Renee Jean, the assistant managing editor of the Williston Herald, and Matt Von Panon, editor of the Forum of Fargo-Moorhead. We will be back with more after today's news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The legislature has passed and the governor has signed a measure to merge the health department and the Department of Human Services. But it won't happen overnight. Fargo Democratic Senator Kathy Hogan says the actual merger date would be September of 2022, but she says it's going to take a while to work things out.
The Department of Health is much smaller than the Department of Human Services, and the goal is to make it hopefully more efficient by doing things that might relate to some aspect of the Department of Human Services over the next 2 to probably 4 or 6 years.
Hogan says for the 2021-2023 biennium, the agency's budgets remain separate. She says the leadership teams in the two departments will be working on the merger. And Hogan says there are plans for consultants.
We think we will have some resources with COVID money, perhaps, to really facilitate outside planners, which will actually be able to put the pieces together in a new way.
Hogan says the state has just hired a new health officer who will also need a little time to get situated before tackling the merger. A new poll shows only 18% of farmers believe that climate change is caused by human activities. Harvest Public Media's Jonathan All reports that comes as there is an increasing focus on agriculture's role in mitigating the problem.
Even though so few farmers think climate change is due to human action, the poll by Iowa State University shows 80% of them acknowledge it's happening. Rolf Nordstrom is the president and CEO of the Great Plains Institute, a nonpartisan energy advocacy group. He says agriculture's role in climate change reduction will have to continue despite those thoughts.
I don't think we have the luxury of time to change everybody's mind, but what we could do is create the market conditions that allow agriculture to flourish in pursuing a low carbon, net zero carbon world.
Nordstrom says government agencies need to incentivize reducing their carbon footprint and play a role in carbon sequestration to make it a financial instead of a philosophical decision. Jonathan All, Harvest Public Media.
And a joint border vaccination program for COVID-19 between North Dakota and Canada involving truck drivers from Manitoba and Saskatchewan is off to a good start. State health officials say 297 people came through the vaccination site at the I-29 rest area near Drayton during the first week of operation. On Wednesday, the site drew a crowd of 108 truckers, all but two receiving their first dose of vaccine. Marie Moe of the North Dakota Health Department says shots are available 3 days a week.
Pull up, they're coming in just, you know, 5 or 6 at a time, pulling into the rest area. They're able to wait to be able to get their vaccine and get back on the road. So I think that it's been going very smoothly. We've heard from our operations center that they've been having very positive interactions. Folks are really grateful for this opportunity that fits in their schedule.
The cost of the program is being covered by the U.S. government. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Hi, I'm Lulu Garcia Navarro. There is a saying that's attributed to Socrates that goes, "I know that I know nothing." With every story, reporters at NPR and this station aim to get to the root of what the story is, not what we think it is. And then we report what we learn. Support the journalism you know you can trust. Give to this station today.
You can call or text the word donate to 800-359-4145 or give online at prairiepublic.org.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and it is time for our April Journalists Roundtable with News Director Dave Thompson, Renee Jean of the Williston Herald, and Matt Von Panon of the Forum of Fargo-Moorhead. Renee, before we started recording, you said that you wanted to talk about a company that is moving out, selling out of the Bakken.
Sure. Actually, Equinor has sold all of its assets in the Bakken. It's basically signed its exit papers with Grayson Mill Energy. It's a $900 million divestment. I guess Equinor had faced some criticism at home that its North American investments weren't doing so well.
Okay.
But they'll still be buying Bakken crude, though. I find that so interesting.
Yeah, but they're taking off.
They're selling the assets to Grayson Mills, which will operate them, and most of the Equinor employees will also migrate to Grayson Mills, and Equinor will still be buying Bakken crude from Grayson Mills. They produced around 48,000 barrels per day.
That is kind of weird. What are the production outlooks? What are we looking at for numbers for this area right now?
For the production outlook, the North Dakota Pipeline Authority, Justin Kringstad, he says it looks robust for the second half of the year. He gave a little presentation to the North Dakota Industrial Commission this week. Right now, we've got 9 frac crews running. They can do about 6 wells per month. That gives us 54 wells a month. That's just under what we need for the state's budget to meet projections. We need about 2 or 3 more frac crews to get to 70, and then we would be 100% even. But with the prices, if prices remain the way they are, and if the pandemic tails off, those are a couple of big ifs.
Right.
Especially with what's going on in India and South America, Latin America.
Right, with those variants. You know,
cases are taking off there, so that could still play a factor in world prices. But that's kind of where we're at right now. We're running 16, 17 rigs right now in the Bakken. Just enough with 9 frac crews to do 54 wells a month.
Dave, going back to the legislature, we have had a lot of veto attempts this time around. There were 4 overall veto attempts, right?
That's correct. And we may see maybe maybe two more now that the legislature has finished. It'll be interesting to see because, he's so far it's 2-2 for the governor.
Right.
Two have been overridden. And one of the big ones that was upheld, of course, was that transgender sports bill that was upheld. One of the things that I found interesting, because I honestly believe that I've been hearing a lot of discussion about this going to court, and it has to do with how federal dollars are being, portioned out. And there's a plan that the budget section would get a chance to weigh in. The emergency commission, which consists of the governor, the secretary of state, the majority leaders of the House and Senate, and the appropriations committee chairs of the House and Senate, they come up with plans to spend the money. The budget section, up until this time, only had a yay or nay. Now the budget section can start making changes, and the governor objects to that, saying that's probably unconstitutional. And I've been talking to the attorney general a little bit, and he thinks the whole idea of a budget section having that much say as maybe a mini legislature might be unconstitutional. That could be another court challenge. We'll see what happens on that, because that was one that was overridden. There are all sorts of nuances that are kind of interesting as an observer to watch.
Right. It's like that dapple tennis that Renee is watching. You and I talked about this last week, but what does this number of vetoes suggest about the relationships between the legislature and the
governor? Let's talk about that, because there are people there who like the governor, and there are people there who don't. We talk about there are several factions within the majority Republican Party. There are those who really like what the governor is doing. There are those who are skeptical of what the governor is doing, and then there are those who just don't like the governor, period. So there are – and it's hard to tell about how many people are in them, but there are dynamics at play all the time. And you saw that during the session where you had this Bastiat caucus of about 25 – that had some differences, especially on things like mask mandates.
Matt, in the Fargo-Moorhead area, we have in April had at least 2 vandalizations at religious centers. There was a Jesus that was painted over a black face in downtown Fargo, and then there was some vandalism at the Fargo-Moorhead Islamic Center Mosque.
Yeah, this is a big story in our area. They don't appear to be related.
Right.
One, as you said, in the dark of night, there was a rather large Jesus statue at the Cathedral of St. Mary in downtown Fargo that was spray painted blackface. And then just a few days later, really, this last weekend, we had a case that kind of shook the community in which worshipers that were arriving for Ramadan services at the Moorhead Fargo Islamic Community Center in Moorhead were greeted with spray-painted words, racial slurs, and swastika, and a broken window and whatnot at their center. And that provoked a pretty strong rebuke in the community, not only from people of all religious faiths, but also the community leaders. And people quickly kind of rallied around. The Islamic Center helped clean it up. There was a major effort to clean it up on Monday afternoon. Mm-hmm. And then on Tuesday evening, there was an arrest made of a young man. And in the court documents, he said that he apparently confessed to investigators that he did it to sort of provoke a response from the community and the media, and that it was a joke, and that he didn't, he wasn't targeting Muslims or anything like that. So that's where things sit right now. And it's been a pretty big story in our area. Mm-hmm. I think there's been several stories done on it, obviously, over the course of the week. But it's a little bit, for people here who really haven't had religious centers targeted for any reason, having two of those essentially in a matter of days,
right,
has provoked quite a bit of discussion here.
We do want to mention a couple of losses. We have lost the Standing Rock historian, the matriarch of the DAPL protests, LaDonna Allard. She has done a lot for the state and for her people.
Well, I met her a couple of times. She was very passionate and very well-spoken about why they were trying to protect the water. And it's sad to see her passing because, yes, she did have a lot to offer the entire state, not just her tribe, but a lot
right.
to offer the entire state.
Yeah. And we also had Minnesota native and former Vice President Walter Mondale. He died on the 19th. Dave, you are the biggest one in politics.
Walter Mondale was an interesting person. I had a chance to meet him in Minneapolis one time. And we engaged in about 10 minutes of conversation. He was talking to me about the political climate in North Dakota. And he was very, very interesting, very fun to meet. He was almost as really intense as Paul Wellstone. Now, I met Paul Wellstone, and he was speaking to a conference where I was at. He came in, "Hi, I'm Paul Wellstone. Who are you?" And I said, "Dave Thompson. I'm from North Dakota." And again, a lot of conversation, and he just wanted to know about the political climate in North Dakota.
Matt, do you have any personal experiences at all?
I do not. I just know that he was very well-liked in Minnesota and was seen as a champion of a lot of causes for the Democratic Party. So I know that Amy Klobuchar, of course, the senator, U.S. senator, worked for him, and she has been out there a lot in the last week or so talking about his legacy.
I want to end on just Trey Lance, number 3 overall pick in the NFL draft.
Yeah, this is a big story in our area. I don't know how it's received in the western part of the state, but obviously Carson Wentz was from
right.
the Bismarck area, and so that probably resonated maybe more so statewide. But
right, but this guy's a Bison quarterback.
Yeah, another former Bison quarterback going very, very high in the draft. Now we've had a number 2 round draft choice and a number 3 round draft choice. Both quarterbacks from the, representing the state of North Dakota, if you will. And it could be argued that quarterbacks for NFL teams, there's 32 of them. They are among the most recognizable athletes in the world, and certainly in the United States. So every time, last night when ABC was airing this this draft live, every time they talk about him, they're showing, him in a Bison uniform, and they're talking about North Dakota, and they're talking about some of the work ethics and whatnot associated with the team and the state, really. It's a pretty big deal for North Dakota, really.
Yeah, well, I think that people were a little worried when Craig Bohl left that legacy of Bison football might not last, but I think they're doing okay.
They're doing okay, and there's a couple more that will probably be drafted tonight. And, it's just it's a team that's becoming really somewhat of a national brand.
We will have to leave it at that. Matt Von Panon is editor of the Forum of Fargo-Moorhead. Matt, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
We also had Renee Jean, assistant managing editor of the Williston Herald. Renee, thanks for your time.
Great to be here. Thank you.
And news director for Prairie Public, Dave Thompson. Dave, thanks as always.
Well, thank you, Ashley.
Coming up next, a movie review from Matt O'Lean.
I'm Bill Curtis. Every week, I open Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me with a pun on my name. While it may seem like fun and games to you, compulsive punning is a serious condition. But with your donation, scientists say they can find a cure. And I believe them. So please give to this NPR station so I can be free of this terrible curse.
Call 1-800-359-4145 or join us online at prairiepublic.org.
There's the fanfare. That means it is time for a movie review with Matt O'Lean. Matt, I watched the trailer for St. Maud. It scared me just 2 minutes and 15 seconds.
It is a scary, creepy film that is finally available to the American public. This was shot in Great Britain in 2019, pre-COVID. Now you can find it on streaming. On Prime. It's also on pay cable, so I finally saw it, and at the recommendation of several friends of mine to watch it. So, yes, it is creepy. It is about a young nurse played by Morfydd Clark. Morfydd Clark is a wonderful Welsh actress who was so good last year in The Personal History of David Copperfield. This is a very different role. She is a nurse who moves to private care because she lost a patient previously, and it really wasn't her fault, but she has this conversion, and she starts taking care of this cancer patient who's a former dancer, played by Jennifer Eilly. And in the meantime, she has a religious conversion, okay, where she becomes rather fanatical and really wants to save Amanda's soul. Amanda's the character that Jennifer Eilly plays, and she wants to kind of save her soul, even if Amanda's not terribly interested in having her soul saved. So it's really a film about religious fanaticism. Where does that cross the line into insanity? So we're inside Maud's head all the time. She is a devout Christian, devout Catholic. She wants to get through to people. How does that affect her job? All the while, Rose Glass, first-time director, gives us this kind of creepy, dark, dank atmosphere. It takes place in a seaside British town, kind of a drab British town. It's always raining. It's always foggy, just like we like to think of Great Britain, right,
yeah.
In the movies. So I love the atmosphere to it. There's really a slow burn. It's a short film, about 85 minutes, but I would call it a steady tightening of the screw film. Where's this going? Where is her fanaticism going? You know, where does fantasy and reality leave off for Maud? And so it's this steady climb to 85 minutes of screw tightening toward what I will say, because you have to see it. It is a frightening ending. It is an ending you will not soon forget. I like the special effects that are used in the movie. Morfydd Clark is very good as Maud. She's a wonderful young actress. I think she's really going places. So I liked her a lot. I liked the atmosphere about it. Maybe it could have been 10 minutes longer. It felt a little short, but it gave me memories of Carrie with Sissy Spacek and also Repulsion, 1965 with Catherine Deneuve, which was Roman Polanski's first English language film. It reminded me of those two movies and kind of this isolated woman dealing with her mental acuity type movie. That's what those movies are about, and that's exactly what this is about. I would recommend this. It's a nice short watch, 85 minutes, and it's streaming now, and it's also on pay cable. So check your listings for St. Maud.
Well, you did spend a lot more time than 85 minutes watching the most recent Oscars.
Yes.
This is another one that went on for ages, it sounds like,
well,
right?
Well, for an Oscar show, it was short, Ashley. It was only 199 minutes. We were done by 10:19 p.m. That's early, considering in my childhood, my old days, my dad and I would be up till 11:30 watching these shows.
Wow.
But this was relatively fast. The pace was very quick for an Oscar show, and that I will attribute to producer Steven Soderbergh, Oscar-winning director, who they brought in to kind of liven things up. It was mostly at Union Station in Los Angeles. There were some nominees that were at the British Film Institute, some in Paris, but most of the nominees were in Los Angeles at Union Station. My understanding was, if not all, pretty much close to all the nominees in attendance were fully vaccinated, so you did not see mask wearing. They were following protocols, so I like that it wasn't a Zoom award show. I am in full Zoom fatigue. Golden Globes were a disaster with Zoom. This was not a Zoom award show, so that was the good thing. However, I think the film look that Steven Soderbergh gave it sort of took away the kind of what we call live tension in the hall. And there were some pushback and some complaints about that, and it resulted in the lowest rated Oscar show ever. Hmm. Now, there could be a couple things at work there, Ashley. It could be that some were turned off by the political speeches, and I also think it was a strange movie year. I have run into so many people, Ashley, who just have not seen these Best Picture nominees. They weren't in theaters for the most part. People have trouble finding them on streaming. So let's see what happens next year if things can kind of go back to the way they were. They'll never be like they were in the 70s and 80s and 60s when there were three networks and everyone watched the Oscars. There's too much viewing choices now. Mm-hmm. As for the awards, Nomadland was the winner, maybe not a big winner. It only won three awards. I thought it would get cinematography and screenplay as well.
It won three big ones.
Three big ones, but it was thought it might win five. The surprise of the night was Anthony Hopkins. Now, I did tell you last week, I did think there was a chance he would pull off the upset over Chadwick Boseman. The problem with the show was they saved that award for last, and it was this abrupt ending to the show because Hopkins was asleep in Wales. He was not at the awards. He released a statement the next day thanking the Academy, paying tribute to Chadwick Boseman. The thought was Boseman's widow would go up and accept the award. It would be very emotional. I think Hopkins deserved it. I told you that once I saw The Father. That was the best performance of the year. It's not Anthony Hopkins' fault that he won. It was a vote that was taken, and he is now the 10th man to win multiple lead actor Oscars. Everything else kind of went to chalk. Frances McDormand, her third best actress win. I was hoping for Carey Mulligan. I think she should have won for Promising Young Woman. But the supporting awards went exactly as I thought they would as well, with Daniel Kaluuya and Yoo Jung-yoon.
And the first woman of color to win a directing award and only the second woman overall, right?
Right. Catherine Bigelow was the first woman to win Best Director. That was The Hurt Locker in 2009. Mm-hmm. So Chloe Zhao, she attended the South Dakota Film Festival about 3-4 years ago. Yeah. And now she's an Oscar winner. So yeah. that was great to see. But interesting looking award show. I'm not quite sure they'll try to repeat that look next year when they'll be back in the theater that they usually are at. I think it's the Dolby Theater in Los Angeles. So we'll see. It was a strange movie year, and I expect the industry to really ramp up this year. We saw the trailer to West Side Story. It looks great. That'll be out later this year.
It seems like they could have maybe at least just let Soderbergh know who was going to win so that they wouldn't have bungled the ending.
Yeah, it's like Fort Knox. Those winners are kept very secret.
All right. Thanks, Matt. Yep.
NPR is powered by local stations across the country, and this station is powered by you. Public radio would not exist without your support. Thank you for 50 years of NPR and counting.
This is Dakota Datebook for April 30th. 24 people were injured, and one man died in a train derailment on this date in 1887 near Sterling in Dakota Territory. The passenger train was westbound on the Northern Pacific Line. Its passengers included two companies of soldiers. The train was 4 miles east of Sterling, going down a grade at 25 to 30 miles per hour when the baggage car and three coaches derailed and rolled down an embankment. Officials blamed the wreck on a sun kink in the tracks, due to intense heat warping the rails. On the train was William Breed, who was headed to Washington Territory from Minnesota with his parents and siblings. When the train accident happened, he jumped from the rear platform of one of the cars, but was crushed as a car rolled over him. He was just 21 years old. One passenger recounted a couple with four little children who sat opposite him in a car. The children flew about in the air like rubber balls, he reported, but they weren't seriously injured. Physicians came from Bismarck, Jamestown, and Steele to assist. The dining car provided meals while the train was delayed at the wreck site. Some of the soldiers imbibed hospital liquor and began to sing. Most of the injured had slight wounds. Among the seriously injured was a woman who sustained a scalp wound, a badly bruised hand, and bruises all over her body. An assistant superintendent of the Northern Pacific Telegraphy suffered broken legs from large trunks and boxes in the baggage car falling on him. Another man suffered a fractured skull and broken arm. People were amazed only one person died. The tracks were repaired the day of the crash, and the undamaged cars were able to proceed after a delay of 8 hours, and the next day's train ran on time. The crushed cars lay in a shapeless heap beside the tracks and presented a most interesting scene, according to a Bismarck newspaper. The derailment was called the most disastrous on the Northern Pacific in months. Railroad deaths weren't uncommon in those days. People died in train collisions, falling from trains, or by being struck while walking or even sleeping on the tracks. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Jack Dura. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
That is it for this Friday edition of Main Street, the final Friday in April. And we want you to go into your weekend, go into your May. Well, maybe you're feeling that May Day kind of help me attitude. Well, get it off to a right start by helping us during our membership drive. Today is $5 Friday. We're looking at you, people who have never joined before. Now is your opportunity to get in to the Prairie Public family to support the programming that you rely on by calling 1-800-359-4145. You just heard on today's Main Street most of the show dedicated to looking back at the biggest news stories of the month. We have a little context, a little analysis. That kind of programming is possible on public radio because we are not airing commercials. We have the time for this. The number to call is 800-359-4145, or you can give online at prairiepublic.org. Get in on this special $5 Friday bonus that is for today for new members. $5 Friday, 1-800-359-4145. Coming up Monday on the show, we visit with the author of For Love of Cod, A Father and Son's Search for Norwegian Happiness. That's coming up Monday. Until then, enjoy the rest of your weekend.